Projectorum, where we, Gareth Miles and I, talk about film, cinema and TV. Hello, Gareth.
Oh, hello there.
That's my Charles Hawtrey impression. It's not very good.
No, yeah. No, please. Please yourselves.
It's Gareth Williams, isn't it?
We'll come to all that a bit later. It's show 209, and it's Wednesday, the 29th of April. And projectorroom.co.uk is our lovely website. And garethmiles.com is Gareth's lovely website. And tedsalmon.com is my lovely website. And you'll find all sorts of stuff on both of those, all three of those. And don't forget PodHub UK, where all the podcasts and all the audio stuff, all the audio podcasts and all the MeWe groups are listed. No, they're not. The MeWe groups are listed at tedsalmon.com. I'll stop there, shall I?
Do you remember that
new section you were going to put in the show called News? I think on the first show after you put that on, we had a stack of news are going on there, and we never had another one. Is that section dead now?
I'd say so, because whenever I find out about some fun news, I'm so excited about it, I go and stick it on my own website, because I might have to wait 2 weeks to talk about the bloody thing on this show, so I'll just go and tap away, blurb something and fire it up there. So I do news. I'm trying to do a news story every day of something interesting in the world of film. Not something that's interesting to everyone, just things that are interesting to me in the world of film and television, because it's my blog and I'm allowed to do that. That's my prerogative and I stand by it.
Yeah. And also, not just to do with film and television, it's quite interesting to see that you post just, it's almost like stuff we have in our Copy Time group or our PSC news group. It's just like completely random things about sharks or about kamikaze pilots or, you know, just anything goes. It's like a potpourri of just stuff that you want to talk about.
Photographs more so, because I have a massive backlog of, not backlog, but I've got a massive archive of impressive photographs, dramatic mm-hmm. photographs and interesting things. Where on your the likes of Google Photos and iCloud and stuff like that, you can write on the back of a photograph now. So I'm putting a description on that and I'm just shoving it on the website as well with a copy of the picture whenever I do that. So it's filed nicely in my own image hosting and then you can go onto the website and see what I've been tinkering with there.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's becoming more interesting as time goes on. So well done. Nice website. Right, okay. Then. What should we talk about?
Films.
Oh, yes, let's talk about films and the Carry On franchise. We need Aidan Bell here. He'd love this one. it was my turn to pick fandom focus this time, I decided to choose the Carry On franchise. The Carry On films are something that I grew up with. The first one was in 1958, by the looks of it, from your list that you kindly supplied in the recording notes. And in 1958, I wasn't even born. But as I was growing up as a child, these films were always on BBC Two on Saturday afternoon, or, you know, that they were on TV channels for anyone to watch. And the Saturday morning cinema sometimes showed one if they had nothing better to watch. Basically, I just grew up with these, and I have seen them all. I've got them all on DVD because I got a box set. Well, no, actually, there's one missing from the box set, I do believe. It's the most recent one, Carry On Columbus.
Yeah.
That wasn't in that box set, but I have got I've got it separately. And it was just so influential, I suppose, in terms of my comedy as I grew up, you know, the kind of bawdy English lewd innuendo based comedy that came post-war, I suppose, as people became less conservative and opened up to pushing boundaries of comedy, and it was just such good fun, headed up by, you know, the usual team of people that did it, and that team moved in and out often. I don't think any one person was in any one of them. You'll correct me on that if I'm wrong in a minute, but it was just stacked full of interesting characters and great actors and actresses, all just having an absolute scream with it. On the face of it, obviously. And I just grew up with it. And if we're talking about fandom focus, I could sit down tonight and watch any one of those Carry On films. If you put it on in front of me, I would sit and watch it, and I would totally enjoy it. And it wouldn't matter which one. It really wouldn't. That last one you mentioned, Carry On Columbus, did get some stick for being, you know, not like the rest of them. It was made much later in the sequence. But I thought it was all right, I suppose, you know. But, yeah. And I know all of those films very well because we've just watched them time and time again. Now, I know that I'm preaching to the converted here because you're also a fan, and I'm sure you've got an encyclopedic knowledge of all the Carry On films that I haven't got. So, do take it away and fill in all the interesting stuff around it, please.
I think it's a franchise that speaks for itself. It's one of those big franchises that has so many entries, you couldn't really name them all. So I know there are people who can, and in order as well, the way I could do Bond, someone else could do the Carry On film, so they do sort of blur together, but there are a number of standouts, and the series sort of peaked and troughed all the way, and you know, it was a great series, and we have so much affection for them because I think for me, I watched them when I was really quite young because they were very tame and easy to watch and had, you know, cartoony humour, so they appealed to children, and they had a tiny bit of titillation as well as you were getting a bit older because you're like, oh, there's a wee bit of skin, so it was something you could watch in the afternoon that was just a little bit rude, and it was full of innuendo, which a lot of people love, myself included. And I dug them all, and I haven't seen them all, but I was looking through
what?
And whilst I say I haven't seen them all, I can't consciously recollect seeing them all, but I know that I've seen parts of all of them along the way.
Yeah.
And having a look at the list, like Carry On Teacher, I've seen parts of that, but I could not say that I've seen it all. Right. And Constable as well. I'm 90% sure that I have seen them, but I can't put my hand on the heart and say, yeah, I've definitely seen that start to finish. But I remember back in the late 90s, I think it was, D'Agostini was the name. They put out a monthly magazine that had a Carry On film stuck to the cover of it, and you put them all together into a box that opens and closes, like a blanket box or box or something like that. And I collected all of those, and I got really annoyed because that didn't include Columbus.
Right.
And whenever I got to the end, you know, Carry On Emmanuel, I was like, this is the final issue. And I was like, well, hang on a second, there's still one film to go. So you haven't completed the Carry On franchise.
Yeah.
But they did give you a couple of that's Carry On discs as well that, you know, kind of filled in because they were the TV shows that had all our TV movies that had highlights, reels and things in it.
Mm-hmm.
But, there were other movies as well. I remember finding on DVD What a Carry On. Was called there was a series of like five films. One was called The Big Job, and there was another one that was set in a cruise ship, but I can't remember what it was actually called. It was like What a Carry On Cruising or Captain or something like that, and they were very similar to Carry On, but they just weren't quite as manic or silly. They were a bit more conventional and humorous, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And they just maybe they hadn't done as well because they weren't carry-on, so they'd been repackaged to make them look like carry-on films. But yeah, I loved Sid James all my life because of that, and I always followed him, and I would watch anything that had Sid James in it, even though he wasn't the most regular of all the carry-on.
Okay, who was?
Troop. I think it was actually Kenneth Williams was in the most. I don't have stats in front of me.
Okay.
I remember having stats before years ago, I think probably from those magazines, where Kenneth Williams and Kenneth Connor appeared in the most, and Hattie Jakes and what's the other lady called with the blonde hair? Joan Sims. They would appear, and Jim Dale as well. But it was toward the end, you know, and whenever they got to the mid-70s, things just went downhill fast, you know, with like Carry On behind. Carry On England was an atrocity. I barely made it through that one. And Carry On Emmanuel, you know, that completely lost the audience. Mm-hmm. And it defied logic as to why that was put together. And then they tried to reteam it for Carry On Columbus. And it was a really good approach that they took, where they went and got, you know, all the funny comedians who were around about 1992, Julian Clary and Rick Mail and Adrian Emmonson, I think, were in it as well.
Yeah.
And it just turned out to be an absolute horlicks of a movie. Yeah. It was not funny in the slightest, despite the wealth of talent that was in there.
I thought it was kind of... perhaps I was just giving it a pass because I'm so in love with the franchise, but I watched it and I thought, this is not as bad as everyone's saying it is. But there you go. And they also moved into television, didn't they? So Carry On Christmas and Carry On Again Christmas. Yeah. And there was a bunch of stuff that were like 25-minute or half-hour slots. Which, whenabouts was that then? When did they move into television?
That'd be the late 70s probably, because that's when they were doing the show reels of the funniest moments and things.
Yeah, but there was like Christmas specials. There was quite a few of those. And what else is there here?
If you were to recommend our listeners to watch one Carry On film, what would it be?
Well, I've got a real soft spot for Carry On Abroad.
Understandable.
I don't know why, but it just it tickles me. I think it's really funny, and it's really good. I'm not sure that I could, because I love all of them, and I know all of them really well. I think Carry On Cowboy is a weak one. I wasn't very impressed with that, them trying to all do Western, American accents, which just missed on all levels. But, there you go. And those two that you said that you're not sure you've seen, Teacher and Constable, those early ones, I think they're really, really good. Regardless is great when they set up this jobbing agency. Every one of them, I think, is just great. But if I absolutely had to pick one, I think probably I can't decide, sorry. What about you?
I did have this once before, where I was going out with a girl from America and she was asking about it, and I hummed and hawed over which one to watch, and I initially went with Carry On Up the Khyber. But just at the last moment, I changed to Carry On Cleo, because I just remembered some of Sid James's lines in that were pantwettingly funny.
Yeah.
You know, what is it? There's a snake, and she says it's deadly poisonous with one bite. He bites its head off and goes,
oh, right. Oh yeah. Oh dear.
Yeah. And it's a bit of a, you know, you just go through it and you get to see all these familiar faces. If you watch the James Bond movies, you'll start to notice, you know, the ladies like Valerie Leon, she pops up in a few of them, and she's in a few Bond movies as well. So they kind of share the British celebrity pact. across them, and whenever you see them, you know, in a carry-on film, they're all being silly and funny, whereas in James Bond, they're all being, you know, seductive and sexy.
Yeah. It's all good stuff, and you could pick out any one of them. Like I said, if you put me in front of any one of them, I would just watch and love it. I wouldn't be saying, oh, I've seen this 100 times, I can't be bothered watching it again. No, I would sit and enjoy it every time, I think.
I always said when I was younger that Carry On Cabbie was my favourite.
Oh, yeah.
And then I saw Carry On At Your Convenience, and I thought, this is going to be a riot. You know, Sid James in a toilet factory.
Yeah.
How funny is this going to be? And it was a spoof of Unions, and I was like, wow, this is actually really quite advanced for what I was expecting. You know, if you watch something like Carry On Again, Doctor, where it's bad and crude, and it was an innuendo at any opportunity, and then you compare that to Carry On At Your Convenience, it's like, wow, they employed a writer for Carry On At Your Convenience who had an idea, something to do with the script, to make this not just toilet jokes, 90 minutes of toilet jokes.
yeah, it was in the middle of the unionization of Britain, wasn't it?
Yeah,
the toilet factory that were they, it was tools down at every opportunity, and as soon as someone says anything wrong, that's it. The what's his name, Bernard? Bernard Breslau was the sidekick. I can't remember the name, the actor who played the actual union bloke with the handlebar moustache. But he was the one that was saying every opportunity, tools down.
The American audience has got the whole Phil Silvers thing as well with Follow That Camel, where they brought in a big name American star, and I don't think it worked.
it was certainly very different, because he played it like Bilko, didn't he, and it was just him. It was an opportunity for him to get the limelight, and they tried to wrap it in a Carry On film, but yeah, I don't think it worked particularly. I think the medical ones were if you took the sequence of the medical ones, they kind of stand alone, like Carry On Doctor and Nurse and Matron, all those ones that were based in hospitals. They could form a little pack of their own, really.
But they lost their way. Like, again, Doctor is one of the worst, absolutely one of the worst. I remember it was Sid James falls in a pile of dirty nappies, and it's just like, is this the best you can do?
Yeah. That's when they were trying to get the contraceptive pills, weren't they? They were trying to nick all the contraceptive pills out of the hospital. Wasn't that that one? Yeah, I think it was. There was the four of them in that Zephyr car hanging out around them. we could talk for hours about Carry On films, I reckon.
Yes. Maybe we'll dedicate a show to it one day.
There you go, then. That's my fandom focus for this show, anyway. So Carry On films, recommended, and you can just watch them on any streaming platform, probably not all of them at the same time, but they come in on and off, and they still show them on terrestrial as well. And go and buy some DVDs, because they're cheap as chips as well.
There's good box right there.
Enjoy them. Right, Private Screening is next, because there's no flop of the fortnight. We didn't find anything to slate, so we had a bit of a to-do this time, and I'm going to be totally honest here. I completely forgot to watch Capture, which we had advertised as the film we were going to watch and put into private screening on this show. And this morning I sent you a message and said, oh no, I've forgotten to watch it. And now I'm busy with my dad all day and I haven't got time to watch it. But it just so happened that you had put a film into the main feature later on that we both watched this week. So I guess you should take it away, and we can replace the private screening with this particular film. Yes,
we'll do that then. On Netflix, it arrived on April 24th, which is a whopping 5 days ago, is Apex. I think we discussed the trailer on the last show in the coming soon section. And I was quite excited about it. I'm not sure if Tedley Deadly was.
Yeah, I was.
This is about a mountain climber who is haunted after a fatal decision in Norway leads to her boyfriend, partner, passing away. I'm not. That's not a spoiler. It happens in the first 5 minutes, and then she goes on a journey to do a bit of adrenaline junkie whitewater rafting. But her journey turns into a desperate hunt whenever a local decides to target her, and it turns into a survival movie where the hunter and the hunted go head to head, that kind of thing. It's one of those films where it's all set in the wilderness, and the one person is trying to outrun the other person, and it's got two genuinely good actors in the centre roles. You've got Charlize Theron as the leading lady, and then Taron Egerton as the antagonist, who is just enjoying being a bit nuts running around afterwards. Eric Bana plays the partner at the start of the film and kind of gets the film going. And anything with Eric Bana, I can absolutely lap up. I felt this was a really good film. I genuinely enjoyed it. I did see an awful lot of negative feedback on it, saying it was just a bit pants and run of the mill. But I've watched quite a lot of films like this. Like Naked Fear, for example, with Joe Montana, which, you know, it was low budget, and the seams were showing and things like that. Here you've got the same kind of mix, but you've got a lot of money behind it, so it's got a lot of polish. It all looks very well. There's a decent amount of special effects that I don't know if you noticed them, Ted, but there was quite a bit of CGI trickery, especially whenever Charlize was going down the whitewater rapids, and I dare say there was a stunt person with a green mask on, and then her face has been pasted onto the stunt person.
Right, but, I can't say I noticed, no.
No, I think it was really quite good. I paused it during that. Was like, I can see the edges there, but it worked for the most part. It is a really familiar story. And it doesn't really provide too much in the way of new stuff, but there are a few wee twisty turny bits here and there to keep you interested as it goes along. The characters are particularly thin, and there really isn't too much motivation thrown at Taron Egerton's character. It leaves a lot for you to fill in the blanks, which I think whenever it comes to this, it would have been nice to have some sort of reveal, or, you know, she ends up back at his lair or something like that. The emotional depth is missing as well. And Charlize Theron's character doesn't really come over as, you know, particularly a grieving type. And it, you know, what happened, the events that's happened at the start where she loses her partner, then it accelerates 6 months later and she's back out doing things, but she's a wee bit grumpier. It's like, right, okay, that's the extent
she's
of
grieving.
The emotion. Well, I don't know that she really was, because
she was it came out later that she was taking his ashes to spread, didn't it?
Yes, yeah, but it's not. It wasn't sort of a real character piece or anything. It was just like, yep, we need to establish a little bit of motivation for what she's doing here.
Yeah.
Edgerton is quite good. He's pretty intense. He has a good look about him, and he is he's enjoying doing his smile, his edgy smile. But I don't feel that it was enough to really, you know, harbor that kind of menace. Yeah, if you look at the likes of Jupiter from the Hills of Eyes or something like that, where you've got someone who's genuinely scary, you know, Edgerton has nothing on that. But I suppose, you know, it still does in a sort of Netflix sanitary clean kind of way. It worked, and it's got thrilling action sequences here and there, and then it carries itself along quite well, and it's a decent enough 3, maybe pushing 3.5 stars type movie. What did you make of it, Ted?
I can't disagree with anything you said. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and it was almost edge of the seat stuff. There were times looking at the no doubt more CGI of the drops behind them and the stuff that they were doing on the edges of these cliffs and the distance down, and my knees were going to jelly while I was watching those. I can't watch those kind of things very happily because my body just seems to kind of react to that in terms of jelly knee. But
even from your lazy boy?
Yeah, exactly. It's surprising, isn't it? I guess some people are affected that way, and I am. So, yeah, that all worked really, really well. I think Charlize Theron played her part pretty well. There were some, you know, some... for one thing, I was going to say that there are some strange decisions, but the whole point of her being there was just by chance, because Taron Egerton's character couldn't possibly have known that she was going to be going there. So it was just like, let's pick on the next tourist that comes along, you know, the next adventurer that comes along. It didn't kind of matter who it was. So I guess she was just unlucky that she happened to be going there at that time when he turned up at a petrol station and happened to see her. It was all very happenstance. At the beginning bit, the tent, they got the Eric Bana and Charlize Theron in this tent, which they're staying on, sleeping in, perched to the side of this, you know, the mountain they're climbing. Good.
Dangling.
Yeah. You know, that takes some balls. I know that people in real life must do that. And that really does take some balls, I reckon, to do that. And then the weather came in, and that whole mountain climbing thing must be incredibly hard to do. And no wonder they want to make films about it. So I thought it was really quite well done. Like you, I would go for 3.5 stars ish kind of thing. It wasn't brilliant, but it kept me completely engaged for the whole time, and I wanted to know what the outcome was. And I think that Taron Egerton's Mr. Nasty was actually done quite well. I think I was more convinced by him perhaps than you were, and he just was Mr. Nasty. Thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'm going to, in keeping with my 3 to 3.5, I think I'm going to give it somewhere between 10 and 12. I should go for 11.
Fair enough. Yeah, I'd agree with 11 as well, actually, yeah. Which is somewhere between 3 and 3.5 stars whenever you configure that to 15.
Right, yeah. So that gives it 22, and that puts it in the company of The Lost Bus, which I thought was really good, and Smoke. Ah, there you go, Egerton, Smoke. He was the loopy fireman in that, wasn't he? Talking of firemen, yeah. And reindeer as well. That's in there.
Baby reindeer.
Baby reindeer at 22. There's quite a lot on 22, actually, isn't there?
It's an easy score.
Yeah, I thought it was a good choice. Well done, whoever chose it.
Yeah, that'd be you. Well done.
Okay, so on the next show, right, just to confuse everyone, we're going to go back to Capture, which is the 2026 film, which we should have been doing on this show. We'll do it on the next show. And the show after that, I will reveal on the next show, because we don't need to do it now, do we? So
exciting. I know what it is, folks.
Now, talking of firefighters and Smoke and Egerton, on the last show, I chose themed treats to be firefighters. And both of us looked at each other and said, oh dear, not Backdraft. Everyone's going to choose Backdraft, and so we purposely didn't. But take it away. What have you found, films or TV shows to do with firefighters? You can go first.
Okay. There was a little TV movie that I've actually referred to a couple of times before, starring Ray Liotta, called Point of Origin, where he plays a fire investigator to see how the fire starts, hence the point of origin of the fire. And it really impressed me. It was just a really good, solid little TV movie that I think actually could have probably done quite well had it released to theatres. John Lemuzo, Luigi from the Super Mario Brothers movie. He's in there as well. Cliff Curtis, who I tip my hat to. He's one of the best actors we have. Ronnie Cox, Bei Ling, Colin Fiore. It's got a great cast, and it's got a really genuinely good little story with a decent enough twist at the end to keep it going as Ray goes around investigating how all of these fires are starting. I guess it's a bit like Backdraft in that way. It's got some great pyrotechnic effects, and it's Ray Liotta, so it's superb. Have you ever watched it or heard of it?
I don't think so. I was just checking up with my list of films and all that and to see if I'd seen
it. Well, of course you would have heard it the last couple of times I've mentioned it.
Oh, yeah. I'm afraid that what you say on this show I don't listen to. So, no, honestly, I don't remember you mentioning it before, but that's probably because I'm just stupid and switched off. But it does look, I'm watching the trailer running through now, and you're right, it does look quite good. And I quite like Ray Liotta at all, as well. And we've spoken about him before. And so I shall now, when I've stopped concentrating on the trailer running, I shall... Yeah, you're right, it does look very Backdraftish, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I think I'm going to track it down and watch it.
Fair dues. Cool. Why not? The other one is a bit of a left field. It was a film that came out in 2001 with Robert De Niro and Edward Burns, who we'll be coming back to later in the show, called 15 Minutes. And I remember this being a bit of a thing. I went to see this in a cinema far away. I'm inclined to say somewhere like Hong Kong or Manila. I can't quite remember, but it was subtitled. And it was about a homicide detective and a fire marshal. De Niro is the homicide detective and Burns is the fire marshal, who try to stop a pair of murderers who are going around videotaping the crimes that they do. And there are a couple of, I don't know if they're illegal immigrants or if they're holiday makers or what, but they are from somewhere in Eastern Europe, maybe even Russia, who come over to America and start being violent and nasty, and filming themselves and getting it on TV with Kelsey Grammer playing a news reporter who ups his ratings by having a little bit of a relationship with them, and they give him the videos and he puts them on TV. It's a surprisingly solid movie, and it's got a really big twist halfway through the movie that reminds me of The Excellent to Live and Die in LA. And it takes a different path to very standard movies, and I was a bit shocked, expecting something else to happen later on in the film, but it didn't. But I really think it's a really good action thriller, and it was great to see De Niro, who was doing quite a few action films at around that time, in the lead role here, and he's obviously doing this because he knew it was just that wee bit different to the typical action thrillers that we were getting. It's worth checking out if you haven't seen it. Have you ever heard of this?
I've got a feeling I might. It's certainly star-studded, isn't it? Yeah, Charlize Theron has popped up again. Look, and
oh yeah,
Kim Cattrall's in it.
Kim Cattrall, yeah,
from the what's it? You know, the
Sex and the City. And David Alan Grier is there.
Yeah, there's loads of stars popping in and out of there, isn't there? So again, yeah, I was watching the trailer run through, and I just had a sneaking suspicion I might have seen this. But I shall certainly track it down again. It looks very good. Robert De Niro, yeah, crossover. There's a crossover there, isn't there, between Backdraft?
Oh, yeah, he was in Backdraft as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Backdraft had a sequel, too. It was called Backdraft 2.
No.
And it had Donald Sutherland and William Baldwin returning. And I know I watched it really late one night, but I remember nothing about it. I don't even remember thinking this is bad.
Backdraft 2. Let's see if I can find it. Oh, yeah, there it is. Backdraft 2. No. I honestly don't think I've seen that. I'm not sure that I was aware of it either. But Backdraft, I did enjoy Backdraft. We all watched it at the cinema when it came out, and then got the...
The one film that we're ignoring, we're talking more about than it.
Yeah, no more. When was it? 1991. Yeah, I saw Backdraft at the cinema, and everyone was all over it. It was the film of the day, wasn't it? 2 hours and 17 minutes. I didn't realise it was so long. It completely star-studded. We should have spoken about this, really. But then we probably have before, haven't we? Let's not talk about
it. Maybe. What have you brought?
We'll talk about Fireman. We'll talk about Fireman Sam instead. Because Fireman Sam, everyone loves Fireman Sam from Pontypridd.
I don't. Pontypandy.
Tony Pandy. Ponty Tony Pandy. It's this Welsh animated 5 minute cartoon thingy. 5 minute? 10 minute maybe.
No, as long as now it's 15.
Is it 15?
Or 10 minutes.
And it was around the late 80s, middle 80s to, well, they've kept it going because they've ripped it off with different animations and not the same people. But I'm not sure how long the earliest kind of run of it went. Do you know?
1987 up until I was about 1994, it says here, and then 2005 it came back until 2025.
Right. And it was just great. It was full of real interesting characters, and the bunch of people who were manning the fire station had their little quirks, and then there was the Italian lady who ran the cafe, and Bella, what's her name? Bella
Ramsey.
Bella, and her son, her naughty son, Norman.
And Nelson. Norman, yes.
Norman, the naughty son. And anyway, it was, Fireman Sam was just great fun. And I don't know why, but I got into it around that time. I think one of my friends had kids that were the right age or something. And so we kind of got into it and started watching, and it was all good fun. It's based in a Welsh little town. It was on Channel 4. In fact, it was on Wales Channel 4 to begin with, but it switched over quite quickly. And then they started doling out, you know, you go and buying VHS videos of it all and flooding the market with it. It was just great. It was character rich, pretty well written. The animation was interesting. It was stop start. What's it called? Stop motion animation. So it wasn't a cartoon, but I think from looking at what's been produced recently, it's very much cartoon, isn't it? Have you seen any of the recent ones?
No, I haven't, thankfully. But I have a son who enjoyed Fireman Sam whenever he was growing up.
Right.
And it was on whatever service we happen to have, whether it's Amazon Prime or Netflix at the time. Mm-hmm. And he would watch episode after episode, and you'd be sitting in the living room on a Saturday afternoon enduring this shit with... and you would have nothing better to do than to start reading into the relationships between the characters. And my wife and I discussed how Norman Price, it was you were looking
for, Price,
is Dillis's child, Dillis, is the storekeeper.
Oh, yeah. So it's not the Italian Bella. Bella, what's Bella's surname?
Oh, I don't know. But we decided that Sam was actually Norman Price's father because they both have gingery hair. And Norman Price doesn't have a father. And obviously he's kind of Dennis the Menace type character who is sadly lacking a male role model, and Fireman Sam is forever stepping in. And we're trying to work out why Dillis never told Sam that she was pregnant with his son, and instead she's just letting him tear around the town, because maybe that gives her a bit more contact with Sam. Because Sam's forever bringing him home, having saved him from, I don't know, falling off a mountainside looking for a peregrine's falcon thing. But, yes. And then we started to realise that, was it Trevor was the bus driver?
Yeah.
He might have been acting as a surrogate father for a while. And he ended up driving the bus. And then Bronwyn, who runs the store, I think it is.
Bronwyn.
Oh, sorry. Hang on. With the departure of Bella Lasagna.
Lasagna, that was it. Bella Lasagna.
Bronwyn took over the Whole Fish Cafe. Right, so yes. And her father, Gareth Griffiths, was later introduced. Of course, yes. It's all coming back to me now. But we were concerned that Trevor might have actually had something going with Bella. And then Bella decided to leave the series because she couldn't take that Trevor was getting together with Dillis in the evenings after he'd finished his boss run. I'm going to stop talking now because I'm starting to get into this.
I'd just like to say I used to like Station Officer Steele. He was great. And he used to say... He used to say to Sam, he'd say, "Carry on, Fireman Sam, carry on, Fireman Sam." And it was just like his catchphrase, which worked really well. There was this other dopey firefighter called Elvis something or other.
That's right, yeah.
And he was really funny because he was so stupid. He was the Father Ted and Dougal thing with that, I think. It was like he was just couldn't put a foot right and didn't understand anything, and that was really funny. Who else is there? Anyway, yes, we should probably stop this now because we're very boring everyone with childhood.
Well, I do have one question, and that is I have an excuse for watching this. You seem to know quite a bit about this without having an excuse. What happened that you were forced to watch this somehow came to it?
I was living with a friend of mine for a while because I was out of a job and I didn't have anywhere to live. And they took me in and offered me, you know, to be in their house. And they had a couple of kids who were just the right age for this.
Right.
So that was the kind of background to it. But, yeah.
I thought you were about to say I was living with my friend. I just sat there smoking dope and watching it.
No. And also at the same time, it was Postman Pat as well. So Postman Pat and Fireman Sam, because of what I just said, I actually know quite well. But
right.
Yeah, so I guess a lot of these things you have to be the right age for, and you have to be introduced by kids around you or whatever's going on. And I'm sure that kids these days will be watching whatever it is on the television now. And that whole thing happened with, what's it called on Channel 4, didn't it? That thing, you know, Muppets. And if you were just the right age for that, you would have been really into the Muppets, and I wasn't. So I know nothing about the Muppets, but you can see if you were just the right age.
They're not even in the same wheelhouse, the Muppets and Fireman Sam. No way. But I would put it out to the listeners. Obviously, they have continued to have children after my child has grown up and Fireman Sam played its last episode in my house. Did anything develop? Was there a further storyline involving Norman, Sam, Dillis, Trevor? Did that become a drama worthy of Coronation Street? Or were we just reading far too much into it?
And there was those other two kids as well, weren't there? Sarah and a little boy. Anyway, yes.
Yeah, no. Bella's children.
Oh, were
Bella Lasagna.
Bella Lasagna, yeah. That's superb. Anyway, the more serious one is Towering Inferno. 1974 disaster film starring anyone that is anyone. If you can think of an actor who was alive in 1974, the chances are they would have been in this film. The story,
Chamberlain.
Yep, he was in there.
Robert Vaughn.
Yes, well done.
Wagner.
Yes, indeed.
O.J. Simpson.
I remember watching this at the cinema with my friends, and in 1974, and I was 11 years old, and I looked like I was about 18, so I got in, and it was just completely harrowing. It was just because what they were showing was not just this kind of this tower block in wherever it was in America, Los Angeles, wasn't it? But they were showing quite graphically people dying. There's a fire that starts in this building in the middle somewhere, 81st floor, I think it was. And the whole film is about Steve McQueen, the fire chief, who is trying to put the fire out, and the other people around him who have been responsible for building this, and the principle, the kind of outcome, the message of this film is that, you know, Steve McQueen was saying, if only they would consult with the fire department when they're building buildings, then this sort of thing wouldn't happen. But in the process, like, nearly 200 people die. But the director of the film is showing burning people flying out of windows in a kind of 9/11 type way, and it was just harrowing. I can remember at my age watching this at the cinema, and I was like gobsmacked. My mouth was agog half the time watching these horrendously harrowing special effects with people flying around and dying. And it was quite engaging. Well, it was very engaging. It was all edge of the seat stuff as Paul Newman and Steve McQueen between them kind of tried to find ways of helping all the people that were trapped in the building to escape. One scheme was cooked up and something went wrong with it. They had to think of another way, then another way. And then you've got a bunch of characters in the cast who were nasty people, horrible people, selfish people, who you knew they were going to get the comeuppance. and all the nice, friendly, good people, of course, were the kind people who were going to survive, hopefully. And all the interplay between the characters and the acting is really, really good. I remember, even looking back at it now, I think the acting is good. And even looking back at the special effects now, I think the acting is good. How long ago is 74? Like 50 years, isn't it? 52 years?
Mm-hmm.
And yet I think it just still stands up. And, it may not be so much directly to do with firefighting, but Steve McQueen is just delightful in this role. He was so engaging and he was owning it. I'm not particularly sure that anyone was particularly stand out apart from him, but I think that it all worked really, really well. And again, going back to childhood influences, I suppose, when I went to watch this, it was, you know, just before I went to the cinema to watch Jaws, and it was about that time where we were all just kind of wowing each other by watching these blockbuster films on the big screen, and we were just the right age, early teenagers, to be wowed by it all and just be, wow, and that's my memory of it. And I thought that Towering Inferno was just great. So it's not a short film. It's nearly 3 hours long, but it's just that the time flies and it's just so engaging. Really, really like it. Do you like it?
Oh, absolutely, yes. For me, it would be more of a kind of disposable Christmas movie. I never got to see it I wasn't live whenever it was in the cinema. Mm-hmm. So I just, what was the other Paul Newman one, When Time Runs Out, which wasn't very good. The Poseidon Adventure and things like that, they were big staples of Christmas, and I'd look forward to seeing that because I knew it was going to be genuinely entertaining. Mm-hmm. And you get to see big stars, you know, in fairly smaller roles. I would say, like, I was really into The Man from U.N.C.L.E. when I was younger, so I would actively seek out things that Robert Vaughn was in.
And
I remember watching it recently, not too recently, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, I suppose, because Fred Astaire was in it. And I was going through a wee bit of a phase where I was looking for off-color movies, you know, the weird movies that movie stars are in that aren't their normal patter. Uh-huh. Like Fred Astaire, being a dancer, made a couple of films like this, and Ghost Story, and... there was one other one that I tracked down. It was a crime movie or something. I can't quite remember what it was. But, you know, just to see them out of their element and trying to do something different. And coming back to this and watching it then, it was like, what a great movie. You know, Irwin Allen, isn't it, was the producer. He knew how to do these. He knew how to pull out all the stops. And he did it well. Yeah, Midas Run, that was the other one with Fred Astaire, yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, no, it's a genuine classic, and it's a thrilling film, and I remember reading in a book about the credits and how they wanted Steve McQueen and Paul Newman's name to be at the top of it, and they couldn't agree which way round they should go, you know, who's on the left, who's on the right, and if you look at all the posters and things, you'll see Steve McQueen's on the left, but slightly lower, and Paul Newman's on the right and slightly higher. And that was the compromise they came up with. Because they're both the big stars.
Mm-hmm. Owen Allen had previously done Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. I loved Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. I was just the right age for that, and every week I watched that on the telly. Lost in Space later on. The Sea Around Us, I don't remember that particularly, but The Time Tunnel. He's done a lot of writing, hasn't he?
He knew what's called Land of the Giants and things that were his, and the Time Tunnel as well. Classic.
Yeah, let's have a look at this DVD cover and see what you're saying about the names. Oh, yeah. Paul Newman's in the middle, but a bit higher.
In the middle? William Holden's on the right, and Faye Dunaway. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
It's a great film, though. It really is. If you haven't seen it, don't not watch it because you think, 1974, yeah. Just go and track it down and watch it, because it's just great. Really, really
good. It's aged well.
Right, okay, that was my pick a theme, Firefighters. What are you going to pick for the next show?
Well, I figured we'd go with Mars. Not the planet or the snack or the god of war. No, wait, the planet. Yeah, we'll go with
the planet.
I was watching, we went to see Project Hail Mary, and it made me want to watch The Martian again.
Yeah.
And I just started thinking, you know, the Mars, there's a great little collection of Mars movies out there, and we'll have a play with those and see what we come up with.
Cool. Okay, then, what should we do next? Let's go to the main feature, and I'm going to talk about Breeder, I think. Ooh. Breeder is a 2020 bonkers film from Shudder, which is about a woman who has been abducted as a part of a gruesome biohacking experiment to reverse the aging process. So there's this mad scientist woman who has decided that she's found some way of producing the fountain of youth, and she needs females to lock up and get pregnant, hence Breeder, because the serum that she uses for the fountain of youth is only got from the offspring of these these the babies that these women create. So she goes around with her two henchmen and abducts women and puts them in these cages and just makes them stay there. Then they impregnate them, not by shagging them, but they impregnate them in the laboratory, and so they all get pregnant. And then when the child is born, they take the child away and get the stuff that they need to make this. It's all completely bonkers. Dr. Rubin, her name is, and she plays the part really, really well, because she's I don't know the actress. I'm trying to track down the. Oh yeah, here she is, Signe Egholm Olsen. She was just playing this Rubin woman really effectively, very convincing. And the two henchmen were nicknamed the dog and the pig, which was really funny. Apparently, I mean, this film is violent, and as we get towards the end of the film, it's ludicrously violent, really. You certainly need thick skin to watch it as the story goes on. I won't give you any spoilers, but it is a film out of Denmark, and it's classified as Danish body horror and torture porn, because it's violent and nasty and twisted, and I think I must be twisted too, because I thoroughly enjoyed it. And so anyone that's normal apparently would find this so offensive that they would just turn it off, but I thought it was just great. Blood and guts and gore everywhere, and inventive ways of killing people and torturing them. It was just great. I really, really like this kind of thing, body horror. Do you have to be some sort of twisted person to like body horror stuff?
Yes, I'm horrified, Ted. Absolutely horrified. How could you?
It was really enjoyable. I have to say, one person in the group agreed with me, and they recommended that if I like that, then I should watch this other film, which I can't remember what it was now. I'll look it up while you're doing your first one.
Bad Biology, perhaps?
No.
But that's got you another rabbit hole.
Here it is. It was, I know, it was John Trimmer, and he said, watch Martyrs, and I have seen Martyrs.
Oh, yeah.
It's a real messed up French film, he says. Yes, absolutely. And he, at least one person out there enjoyed it, this kind of thing as much as me.
Okay, well, you can go for Bad Biology then next. You'll probably... Bad Biology, enjoy that. Okay. Or even Society, that's a very body horror movie.
Oh, I think I've seen that.
Yeah?
I think okay. I have. That does ring a bell.
It's classic 80s. Anyway.
Yeah, there you go. Do you do your first one? Because it overlaps with previous, doesn't it?
It does. Actually, Street Trash as well, which is weird because my copy of Street Trash on 4K was just shipped to me earlier today. It's a good body horror movie. I think there was a sequel recently, but I don't know if it's any good. But yeah, that's utterly repugnant. I can't wait to see it again.
There is a film out there which is the piece de la resistance of body horror films, and it's been banned in every country in the world forever, and it's called Grotesque. It's a Japanese... Oh, yeah. Do you know? Have you seen it? It's a Japanese body horror film. And that is probably the most gruesome, awful thing I've ever seen. And even for me, that was kind of close to the mark.
But really, you loved it, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah.
All right, well, I wanted to throw in quickly that I caught up with Thrash that we discussed on the last show,
yeah.
the shark movie that's on Netflix, and all right, it was a wee bit better than a lot of the dreck you get out, in the same way as Apex. It's a more moneyed, professional approach. I do respect the director a good bit. But it did exactly the same thing as Crawl. But annoyingly, I felt that the first three quarters of the film were enjoyably what to expect from this sort of movie. where you have a couple of different storylines that actually don't intersect, which was something I felt that was unusual. The storylines that of these people as they're trying to escape from this situation where the sharks are coming in and nibbling on them, the bull sharks are killing them slowly, well, actually quite quickly, but in turn. But the last 20 minutes of it, I just felt were just stupid, really stupid. And I was a wee bit let down by them. I was still entertained, but I just felt, oh, come on. You could have spent a bit more time working things out to be a bit more sensible, realistic, rather than just going for kind of cool, man. You might be tapping into the Netflix audience there, but it's not working on me. You know, you think about how well something like Deep Blue Sea or what's that other shark movie that people like? Oh, Jaws. and then you get the ending of this one, and you're like, oh, no, it's not smart, it's not clever. I'm not going to put it in flop of the fortnight because it's certainly a very entertaining film. Just could have done a bit better at the end.
Yeah.
So the one thing I did really want to sort of go into a bit more detail about was a TV series that I watched. It's only a 4-episode mini-series called Vanished. And it's set in Marseille, and it stars Kaylee Cuoco, who is from Big Bang Theory, a TV series I'm embarrassed to say I have not seen very much.
Oh, the girl across the hall.
Does she live across the hall from you?
Yeah. No. I think she's the one that lives across the hall from the guys in the flat. I can't remember her character name now.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
If I click on her name, it'll tell me a Penny.
Penny, yeah. And one of the four guys ends up having a relationship with her.
Spoiler.
I have watched The Big Bang Theory, and I wouldn't mind seeing something else she's in, because she is quite engaging. Anyway, back to your story.
You've seen it? It's an American comedy, Ted. What's the matter with you?
yeah, there are some exceptions. I like Cheers.
Everybody likes Cheers. So Vanished, it's on MGM Plus. It also has Sam Kalfin, who I don't know, but my wife was like, oh, I like him. It's like, right, okay, he must have played Mr. Darcy in something, or Me Before You. That's what she's seen him in. And Adrift. Yeah. And Snow White and the Huntsman. Mm. Other than that, don't know. Oh, he's in Peaky Blinders. Okay, fair enough. But this is a story about a girl called Alice who goes on a she has a boyfriend, and they have international careers. So they meet up in exotic cities for a little bit of loving, and then go back to work. And they're obviously got money and things like that, so they can afford to do that. But they have a romantic vacation together in Marseille, and they're traveling either out of Marseille or toward Marseille, not sure which. But he disappears off the train, the high-speed train, and she's left on her own, not able to speak very much French, with a bit of money, I suppose, and not much else. And she has to try and work out what's happened to him. It felt a wee bit like the movie Frantic, which I've spoken about a few times, with the roles reversed, where she's trying to find her boyfriend as opposed to Harrison Ford trying to find his wife. It takes her through, you know, various different areas of Marseille, which is an utterly beautiful city in every way. She meets a few questionable characters along the way, her boyfriend's boss, a washed-up drunk of a newspaper reporter who seems to know more than she's letting on, the chief of police, when she's reporting him as missing. And when she starts asking questions and probing, this fella turns up and tries to kill her. And she manages to escape him and is constantly on the run. And it's actually quite a competently put together and enjoyable little thriller. I was expecting this to be a romantic drama because my wife was all over watching this. But I got into it. The series does move. It moves really quickly too. Each episode sort of, it builds to a big climax and then hooks you in to watch the next one. And because it's only four episodes long, they're all 45 minutes each, you don't feel that you're really biting off a big chunk to have to work through this. The girl Callie, her performance is pretty good. I really quite liked her. She does a lot of there's a lot of physicality to the role where she has to run from this to that to jump over the here and all that. Is that physicality? Is that right?
Could be.
It's a very physical
physicalness.
Yes, there's a lot of physicalness to the role, and she's good, and she feels human. You know, she doesn't feel like she's Angelina Jolie or something like that. She feels like the girl next door, as she was in that sitcom we were talking about. It's believable. She's attractive, so she can get her way with people, but she's not sort of blowing other women out of the water or anything like that. The Marseille is absolutely gorgeous. Every moment that we spend there and just having her walking around a bit of the countryside and then in the city and things like that just reminds me of just how beautiful France is and what an appealing place it is to go and live for the rest of your life. It's probably very expensive, but I don't know. And it goes. And I haven't heard too many people talking about this show, and I've mentioned it to a few people that I work with, and you know they kind of shrug and I've never heard of it before. And I think it's a bit of a shame because it's better than quite a lot of the mini series that I have watched of late, and it feels like it's a labor of love as opposed to a commercial product that's just been shat out on Netflix, you know, for everyone to watch. At the end of the day, I fully recommend this. Not that you're going to go, wow, that's the most amazing thing ever. I hope they make a season two. It's good, solid Thursday night or Tuesday night thriller show to watch. Good stuff.
Sounds all right.
Nice one, Callie. She produced it as well, so
right.
Top marks to her. Well done, Callie.
I think that she's been very successful on the back of Big Bang Theory. I think they all have, actually. You don't often see them in much else, but I don't anyway. But I think that TV show was a huge success, and they made an awful lot of them. So yeah, cool. I like that. Vanished. I think I'll track that down. The last one I had was a film called In the Blink of an Eye. And this is a film by Andrew Stanton, who has been responsible for Finding Nemo, A Bug's Life, Finding Dory, and all those sorts of animation type things. This one's not an animation. This is a story about... It's a story that spans over 45,000 years of history, starting off in the Neanderthal era, and then leaping into the present, and then leaping in 400 years into the future. So it's a kind of sci-fi thing, a historical sci-fi thing, I suppose you might call it. And the Neanderthal people are... struggling. They're a struggling family who are trying to make ends meet, and we follow them in life when they have accidents and they blah blah blah, and you know, just ordinary life. The present is handled by a anthropologist who is dealing with the death of her mother, and she is working hard as an anthropologist to deal with the hooks from the Neanderthal era stuff that we saw in the first segment, and she's trying to pull that together. And then the third segment is we jump 400 years into the future, and we are on a spaceship that is who's got this character, this person at the helm of it, assisted by AI, who is on this generation building spaceship. So they're off to this new planet in the Kepler system where they're going to start life again, because the inference being that we've screwed up the Earth, so they're going to go to this new planet. And so we spend time with all these three, and the third one, what becomes apparent is that the way in which the people or the person in the spacecraft is able to survive the 350-year voyage because they found some way of making her basically immortal. And so she, as they approach the she's not aging at all, and as they approach the new planet, she's got this brief of using what the girl in the middle bit of the film with the anthropologist, using those hooks to actually make sure that she's got some people with her when she gets there. And it's all very technical and very but the wrapper here is to do with loss and grieving and regrowth, new beginnings. The immortality question is thrown into the mix in the narrative about whether that's good or bad or to be desired or to be avoided. You know, in that and in that Neanderthal era, we don't see loads of kind of dinosaurs or anything, and in the future one, we don't see loads of spaceships shooting each other like a Star Wars thing. It's all about passivity, and it's portraying characters with deep emotional attachments to what they're doing and where they are, and it's shot beautifully as well. I think it works really, really well. There's some genuine chemistry between various characters who are together or are spending time together, particularly in the middle segment and the caveman section. And it's all just done really, really well. There's lots of atmosphere. It's created really nicely. There's also lots of scenery stuff going on. So good. I guess lots of it is CGI, but it's actually quite, looks quite nice, particularly in the prehistoric segments. But you know, it works really, really well. It's very ambitious, I think, and it's worth watching if you want to have a go. Three eras of human existence and human kind of projection for the future, and I think the in the blink of an eye is the reference there is, it encourages you to reflect on your own place in the universe and how your life most likely will be over in the blink of an eye, and actually it's kind of not that important, but let's make the future important. Really interesting project, and I probably explained it really badly, but I recommend it, and I think I thoroughly enjoyed it. The time flew. It's not a long film. I think it's only 90 minutes long, but it worked really well. So recommended. Fancy that?
I watched the trailer a couple of weeks ago and thought about putting it on, but to be honest, the trailer really put me off, and it looked really quite dull and a bit depressing. And I wasn't in the greatest of moods at the time, so I was like, I'd rather watch something like Star Wars.
It's gonna or dinosaurs.
But no, I'll maybe give it a go with your glowing review. Maybe I should give this a shot. The cast is pretty good. Kate What's-Her-Face from Saturday Night Live. I like her. What's her name? Kate
McKinnon.
McKinnon. She's a good actress.
And
Percenda Jones, obviously, as well.
She's in the, and the, her partner was played by a guy who was acting. I didn't know him, but he's called Davy Diggs. Do you know him? He acted really well, I thought.
No, I'm not sure of him.
Okay.
He's in Hamilton.
Oh, that's right.
Thomas Jefferson.
Ooh, he must have a voice then.
Well, most actors generally do.
Yes. Anyway, there you go. So links in the show notes to all of those from the main feature. We hope you'll enjoy them if you fancy tracking them down. And let's move towards coming soon. What have you teased us with?
Okay, we've got a bit of everything in here this week. We're going to start with horror. We've got Affection. And this is, I actually think it's out now. I'm not entirely sure. There's no listing.
It said 8th of May at cinemas.
Ah, right, okay. Well, this looks like a genuinely good horror film. Ellie confronts a disturbing condition, resetting her memory, unable to recognize her husband and daughter. Each reset disorientates her, leaving haunting recollections of an unfamiliar life. So it's very much a paranoid horror thriller where she's not quite sure what's real and what's not real, and her husband there is trying to help her and guide her and things, but is he something more sinister? It's one of those trailers that maybe kind of it's got a bit of guesswork going on, and it seems to be getting fairly good reviews as it stands at the moment. It's been listed at a few film festivals, so I think there's more than meets the eye here. Ted, what did you make of the trailer?
Yeah, I think this looks great. A dark-looking mystery thriller, chiller, possibly horror, as you say. As long as we don't get halfway through it to discover that nothing's really happened and it's all in her dreams, which is just tedious. I was watching From the other day, that TV show called From, and there was about a 10-minute sequence in there, and it was really good and enjoyable and edge of the seat and all the rest of it. And then suddenly the character wakes up and it's all a dream. Oh, for goodness sake. Let's not just make it all stupid dreams. But anyway, apart from that, Affection, I thought, looked really, really promising. Yes.
It's one of those Dallas things, isn't it, where she wakes up a year later and they wipe out an entire season of the show. Yeah, the director hasn't done anything before. However, the actress Jessica Roth, she was in Imposters a couple of years ago, which is very well, I haven't seen it, but it's a very well-received horror film. So I have high hopes. It does look good. It looks like one of that sort of middle ground where it's not one of those big multiplex horror films like Conjuring or something like that. And it's not a cheap, low-budget direct-to-video thing. It's somewhere in between. It looks like it's got money, it's got craft, and it's got good performances. So I'm quite excited about it.
Yeah.
Probably turn up on Shudder or something like that as a quality watch.
Mm-hmm.
Next up is Virginia Woolf's Night and Day. To be honest, I thought this was something else whenever I was going into it. I thought this was going to be a horror film as well. And I actually put it in the show notes before I actually watched the trailer. But I've watched the trailer now, and I still think it looks okay. It stars Hayley Bennett and Lily Allen and Jack Whitehall. Some people love him, some people don't. Timothy Spall's in there too, but this is set in London in 1910 about a passionate astronomer who does everything she can to avoid romantic love and marriage. Her bold challenge to Edwardian patriarchy is set against suffragette movement and advances in science and technology. It's arriving on June 19th. And it actually looks quite decent. Jennifer Saunders is in there. Hayley Bennett, I quite liked in that show Last Frontier. And I don't mind Jack Whitehall. I think he can be quite funny in that sort of bumbling Hugh Grant kind of way. And Lily Allen's always worth watching. And Timothy Spall, the best, is great in everything. Sally Phillips is in there too. So I don't know. I think this looks kind of witty, I suppose. I probably won't end up watching it, but I enjoyed the trailer a bit. Ted?
I probably will watch it. I mean, it's a frightfully twee Brit flick, isn't it? With an attractive little cast, as you say. And it does
what
look... Ho. Yes, what ho, chaps. I say, what ho. It looks like it's been well made, absolutely. The only danger is that it turns into some historic whine about sexism in Victorian England, which, important that, of course, we made it out of that, but I think this could probably go either way, frankly. When you say Lily Allen, is that the singer Lily Allen?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah, Keith Allen's daughter.
I didn't know that she was in anything apart from singing. Right, okay.
Well, she wears clothes, she gets into the bath, she gets into taxis from time to time.
What's she been in then? Greenberg, Elizabeth, Challengers, He's Just Not That Into You. Elizabeth she was in. That was ages ago. Blimey.
It was. How to Build a Girl. She was in that. I was on Netflix.
I have
Comic Strip Presents. She was in that too.
She? Yeah, right, okay. I didn't know she was an actress. I just thought she was a singer.
Ach, it's the same thing, isn't it? Right, next up is, we have the news that For All Mankind is coming to an end. However, Star City is starting up, and that's about Soviet cosmonauts, engineers, and intelligence officers who risk everything in an ambitious space program aimed at being the first to reach the moon. So this is where they're essentially setting up Star City on the moon. And it's shot from the Soviet side of things. This looks absolutely brilliant, absolutely superb in every way. Rhys Ifans stars along with Anna Maxwell Martin, who you might know from Motherland. She was in, it just looks more of the same, I would suppose, but with a sort of a Cold War, the Iron Curtain type. Approach without the American NASA yeehaw type thing. And even the way that this is shot is just beautifully muted and cold, and the colour's been drained out of it in that very Russian kind of way. Ted, what did you make of this?
Yeah, I totally agree with everything you just said. I think it's it seems to be a remaking of the first series of For All Mankind, but from the Russian side. Is that right? It feels like it's the story, the same story, but from the other side. No.
I'm thinking that it's probably starting there, but it's not going to do it toe-to-toe.
Right.
But this would even be set before? I can't remember the first season of For All Mankind now.
Right, okay. They were, anyway, so it looks beautifully made, I agree, and visually stunning, really good acting. This is an Apple thing, isn't it, that we've come to expect this. It's not like Netflix and Amazon Prime flooded with all sorts of millions and millions of things, but the stuff that is on Apple is really good quality, and I think I agree with you, this looks really good.
Yeah, dead excited about it. Can't wait. Next up is a little film called Seven Snipers, heading into action territory here, which stars Radha Mitchell and Tim Roth. And it's about, it's a difficult one. A retired sniper in hiding on an Australian ranch must reunite her elite killing squad when a vengeful warlord threatens her daughter. So she contacts, I'm guessing, six other snipers to come down and help her whenever, what is it they call them, the red bandit or something like that, I can't remember, which is Tim Roth. He shows up to take out her daughter, and the shooting starts at distance. What did you make of this?
I think it looks great. I love Tim Roth. I think anything that Tim Roth is in, I'll just watch anyway, so because I really like him as an actor. But actually, this it looks like it's packed full of tension, and it looks like it's well shot, and it looks like it's, you know, engaging and interesting. Is it a film? Oh, yeah, it is. It's a standalone film, isn't it?
Yeah.
They could have made this into a TV series, I reckon. There's lots of tension going on. And Tim Roth, as usual, just looks like Mr. Nasty and Mr. Sinister. And I think this has got a lot going for it. And I'm looking forward to this very much indeed.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just a solid-looking action film. And it's... well, I lap up anything Sniper. I even love the Sniper series, which is now up to Sniper 11. Believe it or not, Sniper 11 came out a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So if you want to see this, you can set your sights to June 5th. It's arriving somewhere.
Mm.
The last one is a wee Irish comedy, and it's called Finnegan's Foursome. And we're coming back to Ed Burns. I said foursome, Ted. Nothing else.
Yes.
You'd hate it, though. It's a golf comedy. So yeah, it's a sports movie. Yeah. It's about two middle-aged brothers and their respective sons who travel to Ireland to play the Finnegan's family annual golf outing, where they distribute the ashes of the family patriarch. I thought this looked quite witty, and it's tapping into, you know, the Irish golf scene, which is very much a forefront with it happening in, well, Northern Ireland more so than down south, but yeah, I giggled a few times at this, and I thought it looked like a better comedy show. I'm just remembering that when Alan was on, he spoke of Ian McElhenney, who plays the grandfather in it. Yeah, Ian McElhenney's in this. He was in Game of Thrones with Al. Yeah, okay. What did you make of this? Do you like this? Or is it just groom?
I lasted 19 seconds into the trailer. I just thought I would put the data point there. 19 seconds before I thought, oh, for goodness sake. It's not just because it's about sport. It's just like it just felt like lame attempt at comedy, which is just not funny. I don't know. Comedy is very, as we've said before, comedy is a very personal thing, like music, and you know, it's got to scratch the itch of what you like in comedy, I think. And this just doesn't. It looks boring and dull and lame. So after 19 seconds, I threw my hat into the ring. That's the wrong phrase, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. this tees off on June 19th.
Tees off. Well done.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
well,
it.
A nice little selection there. Thank you for that coming soon section. And before we go, oh, you snuck a third one in. I thought there was just two people in the final curtain, but now there's three. Who have we got?
Well, that we're going to start with Patrick Muldoon, who we discussed on the last show, because he has a new trailer for Dirty Hands out as a new action film that's about to arrive. But unfortunately, Patrick Muldoon passed away from a heart attack on April 19th at the age of only 57 years old.
Yeah.
That's worrying. Most people will know him from Starship Troopers, which is one of his first roles, where he plays the dickish I don't think he knows, do you? I was just the doctor. He's a by the book officer, but he was also in Stigmata, and he took over from Charlie Sheen for The Arrival 2, if you remember. You watched The Arrival some time ago.
Did I?
Yeah, we had it in private screening.
Oh,
and
right.
It was meh. But yeah, after that, Chain of Command was a fairly decent direct-to-video action film that he made in 2000 with Roy Scheider. But after that, his career kind of took a wee bit of a turn, and he started appearing in a lot of genre stuff on direct-to-video films and action thrillers and things like that. And he did a turn in Days of Our Lives as well for 496 episodes. So he's been through it and back out again. Dirty Hands actually looks like a bit of a career resurrection for him. Unfortunately, it's not going to last. He'd made Murder at Hollow Creek, which I remember watching a wee bit of a couple of months ago. I saw it was on, and I tuned in, but I couldn't watch it all. But it seemed agreeable enough. But it's very sad to hear of his passing. He was a genuinely good actor. I think he kind of fell in with a lot of similar looking leading men. You know, the Jason Patricks of that kind of time. He didn't quite stand out as much because he looked very much like an awful lot of the competition whenever it came to casting sheets and stuff. But that said, he was a good actor. He was in Marlowe with Liam Neeson. He was one of the better reasons to watch that film. Yeah. Do you know Patrick Muldoon?
I've not heard of him. I'm just trying to look through what I've seen, would have seen him in. Stigmata, I remember watching that. Project Viper is one that you put me onto, but I didn't actually watch it.
Did I?
Yeah, you suggested it. It was something to do with one of your wonky directors we had
Jim Wynorski. Okay,
right, yeah, and you said to me you must watch this, and I never did.
Did I? I've never seen this.
Oh, haven't you? Oh well, yeah. Never mind.
I do want to see it. It's got Teresa Russell and Curtis Armstrong and Tim Thomerson. Yeah, okay, I'll watch that.
Okay, well, perhaps I dreamt it then. Let's see, is there anything else here? There was a Christmas one I thought I might have known. What's the one with the Christmas in the title? Christmas in Palm Springs. All About Christmas Eve. That's a TV movie. No, so the short answer is I really don't know this man, but I'm sure that there's a huge amount of stuff he's done there, so I'm sure I would have seen him in one or two things. Just don't recognise the name. But yeah, that's no age at all. It's really sad.
It is, yeah. Speaking of no age at all, a fellow Bangor man, I was born in Bangor, Finian Garbutt, who appears in Hope Street, which is a locally produced TV show about cops in, well, Belfast and the outer lying areas, has passed away, unfortunately, due to complications of skin cancer, if anything. He was only 28 years old, which is very, very sad. He had a very short career. He was 31 episodes of Hope Street. He's got a feature film on the way called House Jackers. And he was in a short film called To Break a Circle and an episode of Casualty, and that was it. But he leaves behind him a wife and a one-year-old daughter, I think it is.
Very sad.
But, yeah, it's very sad to hear that.
Yeah. I was telling my dad about this today, and because my dad has had skin cancer on his head because of sunspots, like a lot of old, bald people seem to do. And I told him this story. I said, you should feel very lucky you're still alive, because this guy has checked out at 28. Obviously, it's not because of sunspots, but it's certainly to do with skin cancer, which my dad has had. So, yeah, that's really sad.
Yeah, it is very, very sad. Next up is a recent addition that I just threw in at the start of the show, Roger Sweet. Maybe a name that not too many people are going to be familiar with, but he created and wrote He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, the cartoon series and all, based on the characters, obviously, the 1987 movie that came along. And he also did She-Ra, the Princess of Power. And then there's been various different iterations of He-Man over the years. And most recently, the new version of He-Man, or Masters of the Universe, that's about to arrive in cinemas this summer, I think it is. And yeah, unfortunately, Roger has passed away at the age of, I think it's 91.
Wow. My
maths is right.
I suppose that's a very sad, but it's a better age to go than 28, isn't it? Great.
Absolutely, yeah.
Grief. I've never seen or did anything with He-Man and Masters of the Universe. That was something that completely passed me by, I'm afraid. So you're on your own with this one.
Oh, no, I loved it as a child. I didn't have the toys or anything, but I did enjoy watching the cartoon on a Saturday morning and talking about it with my friends in school and things like that. Yeah, very sad.
Indeed, yes. Okay, I think we're done now. So we'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another show, as you will have gathered. PodHub UK is where you can find all the stuff that we're involved in, but you can also find it at tedsalmon.com, MeWe Groups, and audio podcasts galore. GarethMiles.com, as we were saying earlier, is worth a visit. So have a look and see what he's doing there. Really interesting stuff. Our website for this show is projectorroom.co.uk, so we'll have links to all the stuff we've been talking about in there, as well as your podcatcher. So we hope to see you in MeWe, so we can find out what you've been watching and share our thoughts on all of that sort of thing. But yes, hopefully you'll join us next time in a fortnight in the Projector Room.